comfort. O comfort my people, says your Lord. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries out, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? All people are grass. Their constancy is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. God will feed the flock like a shepherd. God will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in God's bosom and gently lead the mother sheep.
And from the beginning of the Gospel of Mark.
This is where the good news starts. The good news of Jesus the Messiah, God's Son. As Isaiah the prophet put it like this, look, I am sending my messenger ahead of me. He will clear the way for you. A shout goes up in the desert. Make way for the Lord. Clear a straight path for him. John the baptizer appeared in the desert. He was announcing a baptism of repentance to forgive sins.
Apologies to any clergy who might be here today. This is going to be the least exegetical sermon of my life. In fact, exegetical will be the only fancy five-syllable word in the whole sermon. There will be no Hebrew or Greek vocabulary, and there I know, and there will be no... You're like, oh, you're wrong. And there will be no quiz at the end. Although there will be a test of sorts. The closest to biblical scholasticism that I'm going to connect to today is letting you have an idea of the setting of Isaiah's words. The voice is that of a person scholars call Second Isaiah or Deutero Isaiah. Oh, shoot. Second Isaiah. Now, there was a guy named First Isaiah who wrote like the first 30-ish chapters of the book. He was doing his thing in the northern kingdom of Israel around the year 700 and change. He was warning about God not being happy with the way they were treating the poor, the widow, the orphan, the alien in their midst, that they were bowing down before idols of their own making, and that God would use the big bully on the block at the time, Assyria, to come and defeat them militarily, which all came to pass. We're now 150 years later, and if Isaiah might have set up a school of prophets or something, we don't know. Someone writing in his name, in that same line of thought, was warning now the southern kingdom of Judah the same warning. But the new big bully on the block, Babylon, a lot of alliteration, here it shows you high quality features. The big bully on the block, Babylon, was also going to be used as a tool by God. And then we're in this part in verse 40. Seems to be a few years later still. So people are in exile in Babylon. It's a giant military empire. An alien nation that is gloating in their victory over Judah, drunk with destroying Jerusalem, the sacred city, and the people are in chains, far, far away. If you want to know the mood of the people to which Isaiah is speaking, read Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our harps. For there our captors asked of us songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of your songs of Zion. They were hopeless and heartbroken. And it is into this pain, this anguish, this angst and hopelessness that Isaiah brings a word of hope. God speaking through Isaiah, saying, comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. A promise that they will return home soon. A voice cries out, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. With almost Buddhist imagery, Isaiah says that humanity is like grass, which may not sound very comforting, except that even the great Babylon is temporary. But God and God's love and God's care is eternal. God will feed the flock like a shepherd. God will gather the lambs in God's arms and carry them in God's bosom and gently lead the mother sheep fold. Comfort, oh comfort my people, says our God. I was told by my favorite professor, Harold Beck, that the job of the pastor was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I thought he'd made it up himself, but then I later found out the saying came from a poem by Finley Peter Dunn, and he was actually writing about newspapers. But the job of the newspaper was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. But preachers being preachers, we grabbed onto it. Seeing our job, and the job of all people of faith, is to offer comfort to those who are oppressed and marginalized and in pain, while crying out against the powerful and the greedy and the violent and the unjust, just like Isaiah did. I have to say that for most humble pastors, the job is decidedly more focused on comforting the afflicted than afflicting the comfortable. There are times to march, and I enjoy doing that with some of you. There are times to protest, and I enjoy doing that with some of you. To confront, to get arrested, to cry out, especially on behalf of those with no voice and no power. But I have to say, I spend the vast majority of my time at this. Between those two things, I spend a lot more time in a chair with a mug of coffee listening to someone's hurt than I do marching in the sun. They're both important. But I spend 99.7% of my time with the one. And I suspect you do. It's not only a pastor's job. It's what we all do. It's what we're all called to do, and it's what we all do, unless we are sociopathic. We spend our time wanting to comfort folk who hurt. What all of us humans who are in relationship with other humans who hurt are supposed to be around. But it's a scary thing to do. We talked last week about vulnerability. And being open to someone else's pain is a vulnerable thing. And we get scared. And the thing that is most scary that I hear most people say, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. What if I say the wrong thing? I remember when we started the visitation ministry here about 12 years ago that Bill Bowman led. And that was the biggest fear. What do I say? What if I say the wrong thing? So this sermon, again, is not exegetical. This sermon today is not going to be about any profound theology. I'm going to be sharing with you a quick, easy lesson about how to avoid saying the wrong thing to someone who hurts. And none of this is mine at all. It comes from an article titled, you're not going to believe the title, ready? How Not to Say the Wrong Thing, by Susan Silk and Gary Goldman. It was in the LA Times, of all places. It was not a PhD study. It was a popular little article back in 2013. And Bob, could you go to the next slide? It looks like this. Here's the basic tenets, paraphrased by Silk and Goodman. Draw a circle in your mind. This person who is a person, this artist, whose name I can't find, it's on a blog and she doesn't actually say her name. Look in the center. It says, draw a circle. And in this circle, write the name of the person at the center of the crisis right now. Now draw a larger circle around the first one. And in this ring, put the name of that person, or the person next closest in the crisis. And in each larger ring, put the next closest people. And that might be parents and children. And then another circle, more distant relatives, intimate friends in smaller rings, less intimate friends in larger ones. And when you are done, you have what she calls a kvetching order. Kvetch, you all know kvetch? Kvetch sounds exactly like what it is. It's a wonderful Yiddish word that means to yell, scream, complain, whine, moan. The person in the middle has 100% permission to do all that about what it is that is hurting. And people outside that circle, their job is to offer comfort in. If you're in one of the outer circles, you offer comfort in to everyone who's in a more smaller concentric circle. Concentric sounds pretty good. If you're in a middle ring, and you need to kvetch, you kvetch the person in the next larger ring. You don't kvetch in. You comfort in, you kvetch or dump out. So I'm just going to read what she says here. The person in the center ring can say anything she wants to anyone, anywhere. She can kvetch and complain and whine and moan and curse the heavens and say, life is unfair, why me? That's the one payoff, the only payoff for being in the center ring. Everyone else can say those things too, but only to people in larger rings. When you are talking to a person in a smaller ring than yours, someone closer to the center of the crisis, the goal is to help. Best thing you can do? Listen. Don't say anything. Listen. But if you're going to open your mouth, first ask yourself if what you're about to say is likely to provide comfort and support. And if it isn't, don't say it. Don't, especially, give advice. People who are suffering from trauma don't need advice. They need comfort and they need support. So say, oh, I'm sorry. Or, this must be really hard for you. Or, can I bring you a pot roast? Don't say, you should have heard what happened to me. Yeah. or here's what I would do if I were you, and then proceed to mansplain, or a woman's plan. And don't say, this is really bringing me down. If you want to scream, or cry, or complain, if you want to tell someone how shocked you are, or how icky you feel with someone you love is hurting so bad, you need to whine, or have it remind you of all the terrible things that have happened to you lately, that's fine. It's a perfectly normal response, but just do it to someone in the bigger ring. Comfort in, kvetch out. Stephen Ministries, a bunch of years ago, came up with a list of some of the things that you've heard when you've been hurting. And here's the things to say instead. I invite you to read that for a minute. Someone who hurts, be thinking about where am I in the circle, and given that position, what should I say and what can I hope would be said to me? Be thinking about who are people in the circles smaller that I can comfort, and who are people in the bigger circles that I can dump to. And the author also talked about some helpful things, and I know you do all these things as I was reading her list. Bring a meal. Who does that better than Methodists and Baptists? Bring a cup of coffee or tea or chocolate, the magic ingredient. Offer to go for a walk. Spend some time with kids or their parents or pets if that's something they're not able to do right now. One of my favorite Christian authors, Annie Lamott, she was recovering from a very bad event, abortion, and she was grieving everything and herself. And her new pastor came by and said, what can I do? She said, can you clean my bathroom? Said it was the most Christian thing she had ever seen was her pastor on her knees scrubbing the toilet. And amen. And here's the thing, going in person seems like it's going to be too much. Send a card. A real one, not an email. Your fingerprints on. Comfort in. Dump that shell out. If anyone's brave, can you say the dumbest thing someone told you when you were hurting? Yes.
Someone told me after a miscarriage that my baby was
angel was needed in heaven. They didn't say God needed a voice to call in heaven an angel choir. Others. Yes.
My mother died earlier this year, and right after Piper was born, people were saying, well, she's here anyway. And I was hurting over the fact that she really wanted to meet her granddaughter.
What others? because people don't have an answer. And so they have to fill up the painful vacuum with a platitude that is long and hurts. When I was in the deepest parts of my depression, for all like cheerleaders, just feel better. Just lift up your lip. You can do it. I don't have a lip to get stiff. My skin's been ripped off. I don't think anyone ever told Barb this, though, because I was in the next concentric circle out after Barb's head injury, which he'd been through several months of QT. And folks, I don't know where they come from. So where's she at now? Like 80% back? Because they're not able to deal with their own pain. They're my example of their own pain, and so how to make, and you have to make sense of the universe. It needs to be ordered, and being in pain, being in unknown, being in a place of pain, you need to save one's life. So, remember the concentric circles. Tattoo this on your forearm, and you'll never be that person. God was not talking to any individuals who hurt, though. God was speaking to a nation for comfort. And that's one of the reasons we gathered here today. Pain, hopelessness, angst. This doesn't come only from losing a partner, or a parent, or a child, not just sickness, but your place in society does that as well. Being a person of color, being handicapped, being LGBTQ, being poor, and all the different intersections of those isms put you at the center of trauma, sometimes a million microtraumas every day. I have a backpack of privilege. As a heterosexual, white, college-educated, cisgender male. And I won't ever equate it, but I spent my entire high school career where I hay and gay rhymed, Mitch and bitch rhymed. I was in the wrong sport, and so I was assumed to be gay, and I got gay bashed every single day. But I never had to have the thoughts going on about how wrong I am. I could have the thoughts about how wrong they are. But I have friends telling me how it is to grow up with the same taunts and insults I dealt with that had to then own them. I tried desperately not to own. And if you're a person of color, you can't even hide, you can't even pass. And if you're handicapped, you can't hide, you can't pass. And it's important to keep that concentric circle model there as well. When a person of color shares about their experience of racism, and I say, oh, well, I don't see color, I just see people, you're erasing their circles of grief. You're denying their reality. We're erasing them and the pain. When a lesbian couple comes to your church to help raise their children up in the faith of Jesus Christ, and someone says that God hates them and their relationship and their family is an abomination, we erase them. We're children of God. comfort, oh comfort my people. That's what our vote is going to be about today. The person who felt that they are not allowed in, that they are not legitimate, that they are not okay, can come by and see a sign that says, no, you're safe here. You are a child of God here. You are respected here. You're saying comfort. This is a place of peace. This is a place of comfort. This is a place of dignity. And so people are comfort and peace and dignity. So our reconciling vote today is a way for us to proclaim that this is a place and we are a people where those who hurt can find comfort. And they will find that through us,